We'll hear arguments first this morning in Ferry against Ackerman. And Mr. Ewell, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, this case should never have had to come before the United States Supreme Court. At its inception, it involved no more than a state common law malpractice action commenced in a state court and involving two private parties, an attorney and his client. Because, however, the attorney received compensation for his services under the Criminal Justice Act, the Pennsylvania state courts concluded that federal common law afforded an absolute immunity from such a state cause of action. It is petitioner's contention that this erroneous invocation of federal law is all that has necessitated review by this court. Two obviously related and often intertwined questions are presented by this case. First, does federal common law have any rightful place in a state law action for malpractice commenced by an indigent against a private attorney in a state court who was appointed to represent him in a federal criminal proceeding under the Criminal Justice Act? And second, if in fact federal common law is applicable, what is the nature of that federal common law? Is the immunity that this court has afforded to judges and prosecutors equally applicable to the office of court-appointed counsel? Francis Rick Ferry, petitioner herein, was indicted by a grand jury, a federal grand jury, sitting in the Western District of Pennsylvania. He was charged with violation of both the United States Criminal Code and the Internal Revenue Code. Because he was an indigent, counsel was appointed to represent him. Mr. Daniel Ackerman, the respondent herein, was appointed to represent Mr. Ferry in this criminal proceeding. Although the 3-year statute of limitations on the Internal Revenue Code counts had run by the time the indictment was filed, Mr. Ackerman at no time moved to dismiss the indictment, nor in any other way raised the statute of limitations defense. Mr. Ferry was convicted and sentenced to 20 years on the counts under the Criminal Code and 10 years to run consecutive to the Criminal Code counts on the Internal Revenue Code counts. On appeal to the United States Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit, Mr. Ferry, who was by this time represented by new counsel, did raise the statute of limitations issue, but the Third Circuit, in a judgment order, concluded that the statute of limitations had been waived by its failure to have been raised at trial. It is this failure to raise the statute of limitations defense that constitutes the thrust of Mr. Ferry's present malpractice issue, malpractice common law action that he instituted in the Pennsylvania courts. Pennsylvania courts dismissed the suit on the ground that federal common law provided an absolute right of immunity against such suits. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court concluded, first of all, that they were required by this court's decision in Howard versus Lyons to apply federal law to the question of potential liability here, and second of all, that the federal common law rule of immunity that has applied to judges, federal judges under Bradley versus Fisher, and federal prosecutors under Yaselli versus Goff, applied with equal force to court-appointed counsel. Petitioner submits that they were wrong on both aspects of this case, on their decision to invoke federal common law, and second, in their ascertaining what, in fact, that federal common law was.
If we should agree with you on the first point, that they were wrong in believing that federal common law was applicable, I suppose the appropriate action on the part of this court would then be to remand the case to the Pennsylvania courts for them to decide it under state law, wouldn't it?
Yes, that is what the petitioner seeks, and I think that is what, even if the court decides the question on the second issue, concludes that there is federal common law, but that federal common law does not afford immunity, I think that the question of state law and whether state law affords immunity will be open nevertheless.
Well, if we agree with the Pennsylvania courts that federal common law is what is governing here, then we would proceed to decide whether or not we agree with them as to what the federal common law is.
Well, that's correct. But
and,
if this
there would be no remand, would there?
Well, I would think, Your Honor, that if this court concluded that federal common law was applicable,
yes,
and that federal common law afforded no immunity, I think it would still
well,
be within
then
the...
Then there would be a remand. But if we agreed with the Pennsylvania Supreme Court that
on both
federal
questions,
common law
yes.
is applicable and that it grants the kind of immunity that Pennsylvania believed it did, that's the end of the case.
That's correct.
Howard against Lyons was a diversity action, was it not?
Yes, it was. It was in the federal courts.
But it was in the federal courts, but they were required to apply either some sort of federal common law privilege or the law of the state applicable. It was not brought under any federal basis of jurisdiction.
No, it was purely a diversity common law, a state common law action for defamation.
So it was akin to this case in that it
except that that was instituted in the federal court and this was instituted in the state court. But aside from that, it is akin to this case. I should bring to Your Honor's attention that the Pennsylvania Supreme Court currently has for it a case dealing with the question of whether or not there is immunity under state law.
It's done what with that question?
It has that case currently before it now. Case
hasn't decided it.
That's correct. The case is Reese versus Danforth. The case has been briefed. The case has been argued, but no decision has been rendered on that particular case.
Well, the Court of Common Pleas, or is it going beyond that?
It has come from the Superior Court. It is presently before the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. And the Pennsylvania Supreme Court did choose to hear the decision from the Superior Court.
On some sort of an interlocutory appeal?
No, the lower court dismissed the action on the grounds that there was an absolute immunity under state law. And that question is currently before the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, yes.
That was an appointed counsel?
That's a state public defender.
In a state court.
That's correct. It's in a civil commitment action. Mm-hmm. It is not in a criminal proceeding. It is in a civil commitment proceeding that has taken place. The lower court concluded that there was immunity. Both sides referred to that case in the lower court decision.
Right.
It has subsequently come before the Pennsylvania Supreme Court.
The Pennsylvania rule, if it's a state law rule, wouldn't be binding, I suppose, in a 1983 action against this lawyer whom you refer that's presently pending in the Supreme Court.
No, it definitely would not. It indeed is my argument that the decisions in the 1983 actions, many of which have been dismissed for want of color of law, are entirely consistent with my position that this is not a federal officer and therefore there is no need to apply federal law to this particular case.
What would you say if the if this involved an employee of the United States, an employee as a public defender? In some districts, they take care of the constitutional right of defendants by having a public defender's office.
I believe that every district has a mixed plan.
Well, what about a public defender?
A public defender...
An employee of the United States.
A public defender does raise different situations, a different problem. I do think, not insofar as the immunity question, but certainly insofar as whether that person constitutes a federal officer. More of an argument could be made because the trappings of office are present in that particular case.
Well, in that case, let's assume that the public defender, an employee of the United States, did such a bad job of representing the defendant who is convicted, that his conviction is reversed because of that he had inadequate counsel. It was so bad that the conviction was reversed. That the defendant was denied his constitutional right. And then the defendant sued the counsel who had been representing him to recover under a Bivens type of action. What would you say then? Wouldn't that be a federal issue then?
Well, I think that in that particular case, if it was under Bivens or if it was against the United States government under the Federal Tort Claims Act, certainly more of an argument could be made that there was a color of law provision. The Seventh Circuit in Robinson versus Bergstrom, for example, recently distinguished the public defender's office.
If you agree that federal law would govern the public defender, you think there's a different rule would apply to his colleague who was just appointed?
Well, I think that the answer in both cases would be that there would be no immunity. I think whether or not that there ought to be no immunity as a matter of federal law or state law is different. The public defender is potentially may be potentially the subject of a suit against the United States government under the Federal Tort Claims Act. He may be deemed to be an employee. No circuit has yet decided that question. It has been decided, however, that a private court-appointed lawyer is not an employee of the government, and therefore no suit lies against the government. I think that
under our cases under the Federal Tort Claims Act, is it not reasonably clear that if it's a federal function, it's a discretionary federal function that would be exempt from any liability on the government as distinguished from the individual?
Well, Your Honors, I think that what took place in this particular case is not a question of a discretionary judgment. I think failure to notice statute of limitations...
No, I didn't use discretion in that sense. Discretion in the sense that it's used, a discretionary governmental function in the sense that's used under the Federal Tort Claims Act and under our cases relating to that act. And I'm only speaking to the liability of the government, not the liability of the individual.
Perhaps there would be no liability to the government under the Federal Tort Claims Act, but not, I think, on the ground that that individual was not an employee. The cases dealing with private court-appointed attorneys have been decided on the ground that that individual is not even an employee who falls within the Federal Tort Claims Act. The 1983 actions similar against court-appointed counsel have almost uniformly been dismissed for want of color of law. The courts, at least the lower courts, have treated public defenders somewhat differently. My contention is that on the question of immunity, while there are different considerations, I think one of the most important different considerations that are involved is that a public defender is prohibited from the private practice of law. That is, 100% of all his cases would be appointed cases. The private court-appointed lawyer appointed under the Criminal Justice Act is not so prohibited. Indeed, most of them do have a substantial portion of their practice in the private retained domain. I think
that... Let me change that a little bit.
Could Congress, by statute, grant absolute immunity to a Criminal Justice Act appointed counsel and public defenders and do so consistently with the Constitution, in your view?
Your Honors, I believe that it might be possible. In that particular case, I think a very different constitutional problem would be raised than is raised by this particular case. There would then be a legislative judgment, an empirical finding of the interest of the federal government and the danger that it posed to the representation of indigents to have potential liability. I do think
the first question would be one of congressional power under the Constitution, wouldn't it?
Whether Congress could grant that. I think, however, Your Honor, that Congress would be able to...
Under what provision of the Constitution? Under which one of its constitutional powers?
Well, perhaps pursuant to the Spending Clause. If, in fact, they were allocating money, they might be able to put limitations on the receipt of that money under the Spending Clause. I think, however, it might create some Sixth Amendment problems. If, in fact, the source of the individual's right to be represented is not Congress, but is the Constitution, as this Court has made clear, then all Congress is doing is compensating. And if, in fact, it is concluded that the immunity that is granted provides for less effective representation than if a person is potentially liable, I think it would have Sixth Amendment problems.
It's true that you can talk that way about Congress, but if you talk about the United States, the interest of the United States is broader, seems to me to be a rise under the Constitution. It is doing its constitutional duty to appoint counsel. And it certainly is a federal function. And I suppose you would agree that whether or not the counsel has performed his duty in the federal court adequately is a matter of federal law.
Well, Your Honor, not entirely.
Well, I'm sure it would be if the defendant appealed on the grounds that he had had such inadequate counsel that his conviction should be reversed.
Perhaps under 2255. It is, however, within the domain of all these state Supreme Courts of these United States to adjudge the quality of representation and take disciplinary action against lawyers, even if that representation took place in a federal criminal proceeding. And in those cases, I would believe that the state laws, the disciplinary laws which control conduct, would be the governing rules on the appropriate discipline to be taken against particular lawyers.
Well, you wouldn't think that, would you think that Congress could not prescribe the standards for lawyers who are operating in the federal courts?
No, I would have no difficulty with that type of legislation.
And,
I think
including
Congress could.
Those who are appointed to represent indigents.
Certainly, I
and
think.
And providing for liability if they breach those standards.
Certainly, I think that Congress could do that. Whether Congress, I believe that Congress could perhaps even grant immunity to private court-appointed lawyers. I do think it would create some equal protection problems. I do not think it creates anywhere near the amount of equal protection problems that are created where we have a rule that is not subject of congressional action, where there is no need for the deference to the wisdom of the law or the deference to the legislative judgment or the majoritarian will or the empirical fact-finding that has been, in fact, engaged in by the legislative process. I think the scrutiny of a common law action ought to be greater than that when we deal with when this court deals with congressional legislation.
Let's back that up for another hypothetical. Suppose the judge who made the appointment was guilty of such gross negligence in appointing an obviously incompetent person. Would there be any liability on the judge, or would he have absolute immunity under our holdings?
I think he would have absolute immunity. I think certainly the state judge under Stump versus Sparkman, Pearson versus Ray, and the federal judge as well. I think there would be no difficulty with that question. As well with the prosecutor. I think the prosecutor would be in the same position as the judge. But there are a very different situation presented here, not only because that individual is much more clearly not only an officer of the government, but indeed represents the government. But I think policy-wise, there's a very different situation that the judge or the prosecutor is in than the court-appointed counsel. The judge and the prosecutor owe their duty to the public, not to the specific individual. Their overriding duty is to the public, and very often they may have to act, and indeed do act, in ways that are not in the best interest of that particular individual, because their duty is to act in the best interest of the public. When we deal with court-appointed counsel, we deal with a person who owes his primary duty to the client. Therefore, the creation of liability at the hands of the very person to whom, if not the sole, certainly the primary duty is owed, does not create the potential conflict that subjecting a judge or a prosecutor would.
What is your understanding about the obligation of an attorney in your state or in your district to respond to an appointment? Would a judge hold a person in contempt if he declined to represent a defendant?
I'm not sure, Your Honor, because the present procedures for the Western District of Pennsylvania do not utilize that type of involuntary appointment.
Well, anyone who wants out can get out in your district.
The person would have to volunteer to be put on the list.
I see. So he is voluntarily walking into a situation that at least he's not involuntary. He's not performing some involuntary service.
That's correct. He's being compensated, and he is also volunteering.
And if he volunteers, he then at least purports to be competent to accept and discharge an appointment.
Well, that's correct, except that the district does engage in certain type of standard making themselves in looking into the qualifications of the particular individual, and people are in fact.
But at least it isn't a situation where he says, "Judge, I'm just not a criminal lawyer. I don't know anything about it. I don't want to do it." He's not forced to do it.
That's correct, and I believe.
And he purports to be able to satisfy the standard.
That's correct. As to whether a person could in fact be forced to, and whether that in fact would create some constitutional problems, as has been suggested. I do not know. It has not come up in that district because there is no such procedure that exists in that particular district. Howard versus Lyons application to a federal officer is undisputed. What is contended by petitioner is that this individual is simply not a federal officer. His source of authority is not the federal government. It is the state that licensed lawyers. Is the state that judges standards for lawyers. While one would have to be admitted to that particular district, most of the United States district courts have almost an automatic admission policy for individuals solely upon their admission to that state bar.
It's your position in the Pennsylvania could go either way as to immunity in this case as a matter of state law.
That's correct, Your Honor. I do not know how Pennsylvania will go in that particular case, and I believe it's possible that they go either way. I should like to call to Your Honor's attention, although it's certainly not binding on the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, that neither counsel in that case has argued for absolute immunity. They have only argued for qualified immunity in that particular case. Certainly the Pennsylvania Supreme Court is not bound by that decision, and they may conclude that there is absolute immunity. But in any event, it's somewhat distinguishable on its facts from this particular case and may not govern in any event in that that is a civil proceeding and not a criminal proceeding that is involved. There's a public defender who has represented an individual in a civil commitment action.
Mr. Yulee, as a matter of Pennsylvania law, what sort of immunity does a judge and a prosecutor get?
Absolute immunity, Your Honor.
Do you think there would be a difference between the responsibility of the counsel in a civil case and a criminal case?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that when we deal with the individual's right, the individual has a constitutional right to be represented by counsel in the criminal action. And so we're dealing with more than a right that is afforded as a matter of...
That's a federal right.
That's correct. It's a federal right, but it also applies in state proceedings as well. But that right may distinguish a civil commitment proceeding in that the problem which is faced when one deals with civil proceedings is that very often what one has are volunteers, individuals who take pro bono cases. That would not be the case, certainly, in a federal criminal action, unless that individual, for some reason, wished to take it without the compensation offered by the Criminal Justice Act. Whether volunteers would create a different situation or not, it certainly would not be a matter of federal law if an individual volunteered to represent a person in a particular action.
Well, supposing you're counsel for a defendant who is convicted in a federal court, and you are suing the lawyer who represented him in the federal court, and you're suing him under state law, just like this, like in this action, and he raises a defense of immunity under state law. I take it you would not move to strike that defense as wholly improper.
No, indeed, I would think that under Erie that the federal court would be bound to apply.
This would not be the federal court. You're suing him in state court.
Then certainly the state creating immunity to a cause of action it itself has created would create no problems insofar as the choice of law problem. The individual who is bringing the action here is bringing an action against an individual who owes him the duty of effective representation. As I indicated earlier, this distinguishes judge, it distinguishes the prosecutor. Those individuals, this court's grant of immunity to those individuals has been precisely because the court did not wish to create the conflict between, on the one hand, the duty imposed by law, the duty to the public in the public interest, and on the other hand, the duty to the particular individual, or at least the fear that the particular individual before him will subsequently sue him for malpractice or potential liability.
You don't really contend that neither the prosecutor nor the judge owes the defendant in a criminal trial any duty at all. You don't contend that.
No, I don't contend that. But I do contend that the problem is that there is a conflicting duty there and that the judge's public duty is to decide in the best interest of the public.
Well, there's some constraints on counsel representing a client, too.
Well, there certainly are with regard to the disciplinary rules that govern his conduct. Incidentally, one of those disciplinary rules is the rule that an attorney may not contract with his client to provide immunity from suit. In any event, the suit against the counsel would, however, be with regard to a duty that was primarily owed to the client, and the conflict between the self-preservation instinct, which this court has recognized in those immunity cases, and the duty that is imposed would not be present, because here they would coalesce. That is, the self-preservation instinct would be protected in the very same way that the performance of the duty imposed by law would be protected. This court, and I think that it's the case that I find most clearly on point. In Murray versus DeKalb County, concluded that in a state cause of action, in a state court, between two private parties, even where the federal government had provided compensation, which had, in fact, in that case, created the duty to provide for safety in the Murray case, this court concluded unanimously that there was no need for federal law to apply. The analogy, I think, is quite clear. We have a contractual arrangement. The government is providing the funds. The recipient of the funds has not performed the duty imposed upon him when those funds were granted. And the individual, whether he is suing as an implied beneficiary of that contract or suing instead in malpractice, which is in itself a combination of a tort action and a malpractice action, the potential liability of that individual, even though they are a recipient of federal funds, should be a matter of state law. We contend, however, not only that it should be a matter of state law, but that in fact, if federal law is found to be applicable, that that federal interest here would not be an interest in immunity, but would be in accountability. In Butts, this court indicated that an individual who seeks immunity from suit has the burden of proving that there is a need for such immunity. I think here, the burden has not been sustained. Immunity would discourage precisely that which immunity is designed to encourage,
this
vigorous
part of,
performance
this part of your argument,
of duty, yes.
At this stage in your argument, you're assuming that you lose on the, and that federal common law is applicable.
That's correct. That's correct. As I indicated, even if this court concludes that federal common law is applicable and that federal common law affords no immunity, I think that it would still be within the right of the state court to impose immunity itself. Even if the federal, even
yes,
if
yes,
this.
Yes, but now you're assuming that your first argument that federal common law is inapplicable has been rejected. And
that's correct. The second issue is not necessary to be reached if the first is decided.
Right.
In,
right.
Yes. The federal government's interest, if any here, is in a standard of care for indigents. The purpose of the Criminal Justice Act was to improve those standards. Immunity is an illogical way to approve those standards. Not only are the policy reasons clearly against it, but this court ought to be concerned with the appearance of justice as well, the appearance of treating the indigent who is unable to afford his attorney differently than it treats an individual who can retain attorneys. The mistrust that exists between lawyers, court-appointed lawyers, and the indigent is hardly likely to be helped by the absolute grant of immunity on the part of the federal government. At this point in time, it seems to me an unwise thing for, in view of the cynical attitudes that have developed around the legal profession in general, that a different rule should be established with regard to lawyers than has been established with regard to doctors. Physicians are liable even if they receive Medicaid funds. The mere receipt of Medicaid funds does not distinguish the case from a physician who, in fact, has been paid, has been retained by.
But the government doesn't give Medicaid funds pursuant to the United States Constitution.
That's correct.
There is a difference.
That's correct. In this case, it would be even stronger. But in that case, where it is weaker, the federal government interest certainly, or the indigent's interest is weaker. Nevertheless, the legal profession has treated the fully paid physician the same as it has treated the one who is the recipient of a federal funding program.
That's not a case from this court, is it?
No, that's certainly not a case from this court. The physicians who do work for the federal government, that is, Veterans Administration physicians, public health physicians, and armed forces physicians, Congress has legislated as to all three of those, and Congress has created an exclusive remedy against the United States government and has in turn afforded an immunity of sort to those physicians in return for creating the absolute or exclusive right of action under the Federal Tort Claims Act. And Connecticut has adopted a similar approach with regard to public defenders and court-appointed attorneys. Connecticut Supreme Court held that there was potential liability on the part of public defenders and that there was no immunity as a matter of state law. The Connecticut legislature has subsequently passed a statute, and that statute has created an exclusive right of action against the state in return for immunity.
Very well. Mr. Arness.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. The issue in this case is not whether immunity would best serve the private interests of an indigent defendant or whether immunity would best serve the private interests of a court-appointed attorney, but rather whether the doctrine of immunity would best serve the public interest, particularly in ensuring the proper functioning of the criminal justice system. We contend that the considerations found determinative in this Court's prior decisions are fully applicable to this case. These include the fact that the threat of litigation may influence the manner in which the person involved performs his duty. The fact of litigation will inflict harassment upon such persons so as to deflect their energies from the duties which they are obliged to perform in order to analyze and meet the charges with which they will be faced. The threat of litigation would make service in an already burdened system less attractive and make it more difficult to encourage well-motivated and competent.
In this case, all this case tells the defense counsel is be sure and raise your defenses. Is that what this case tells it? And my second question, if so, how does that hurt due process of law?
Your Honor, because that same theory or same set of situations could govern almost all of the activity of the appointed attorney, and if he had to guard...
Now, I don't know how many appointed attorneys run up against the statute. Not many, I'm sure.
But whether or not to plead the statute of limitations...
Well, that's what this case is.
That's what this case is, yes, Your Honor.
And you can't read that out of this case.
That's correct. But it's no more blatant, Your Honor, than... Then
Mr. 20 years because of what this man did.
No, the 20 years, Your Honor, was for putting a bomb in a car and injuring someone. The 10 years on top of that was with reference to the Internal Revenue Count.
I'm wrong on 10 years.
Yes.
But he got 10 years.
Yes, and he's now filed a motion under 2255, as the reply brief of petitioner has shown, which is perfectly capable of curing that error, if indeed it be error. You know, the statute of limitations, Your Honor, if I may digress for just a moment, is not just the responsibility of counsel, but the United States attorney indicted, apparently. The judge didn't pick it up.
Well, you can't sue the United States attorney.
No, Your Honor.
You can't sue the judge.
And we respectfully
and now
submit.
You can't. So in a situation where the judge is asleep, the U.S. attorney is asleep, and defense counsel is asleep, you got 10 years coming.
Yes, and Your Honor.
Is that what this case is?
In that context, certainly, Your Honor, it is. But we respectfully submit that the Criminal Justice Act and the system is not well served by permitting to sue anyone who is an integral part of the judicial process. There are much better means of handling that situation, both for the indigent defendant involved and for the public. Now,
this case, if liability is to be imposed or if immunity is to be granted, involves a great deal more than just forgetting about the statute of limitations. It involves every aspect of the trial of the case, does it not?
Yes, indeed, Your Honor. And as I pointed out, this Court has never been dissuaded from handling the policy considerations involved by the particular conduct. If it were, then the suppression of evidence by Mr. Pachman would not have been tolerated. And in the Imbler case, there would not have been declared an absolute immunity. You cannot, we respectfully submit, handle cases that have such far-reaching policy considerations behind them on the basis of the particular conduct being charged in a particular case. And whether or not this conduct was reprehensible, of course, would be decided on a trial on the merits, and we do not know that. But that's not before the Court. The problem before the Court is whether public policy requires the doctrine of immunity to
be available so as not to have an adverse impact on the functioning of the criminal justice system.
Let me give you a hypothetical. Suppose after the defendant was convicted, the defendant from prison brought suit for malpractice, saying that the defense counsel told him there was no chance of an acquittal unless he testified, that was the considered judgment of defense counsel. And so the defendant decided to testify and then was exposed, of course, to the usual cross-examination. And now his claim is on one thing only, namely that that was bad advice, and that exposed him to the conviction and brought about the conviction. That would be a grounds for a malpractice suit, would it not?
Yes, Your Honor, it would.
Under a holding of liability.
If malpractice suits are to be permitted, any grounds which smack of a counsel giving improper advice would be grounds for that action as a matter of law. Now, you'd have to prove it, of course,
under the
standards. Or if the
defense counsel decided not to cross-examine a prosecution witness, that might be a basis for a malpractice suit, too.
Yes, Your Honor.
Isn't that true, despite this case, that if it's paid counsel, that's possible?
Yes, it is, Your Honor. The difference is,
in all those hypotheticals, if it's paid counsel, you can try a malpractice.
Yes, Your Honor, and there are two important distinctions, however. The paid counsel does not have an involuntary relationship where the threat of litigation is as real as it is in an involuntary relationship such as court-appointed counsel have. Secondly, the private attorney is not performing a governmental function. Now, it is because this court, in Johnson versus Zerps and in Gideon versus Wainwright, and then Congress has enacted the Criminal Justice Act, has made this function a governmental function.
Well, why isn't the privately paid counsel performing a governmental function? He's performing it because the court has said the Constitution requires that there be counsel.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is that not so?
I think, yes. My answer would be, Your Honor, that court has said that is a constitutional right. Congress could have said in the Criminal Justice Act that all people, regardless of means, were entitled to free appointed counsel. Congress did not. Congress chose to implement the decision of this court by depriving people of means of that benefit and giving it only to people who can show that they cannot afford it. That is a legislative decision,
but the root of the matter, that is the requirement of the presence of counsel, stems from the Constitution in both cases, does it not?
It does, Your Honor. And yes, it does. And respondent would be perfectly happy for the purpose of this policy argument to have it apply across the board. However, we maintain that it's the performance of the governmental function that distinguishes this case from others, and that is the critical area. Both public defenders and private attorneys appointed under the Criminal Justice Act are performing a governmental function as the Criminal Justice Act intended they perform it.
Mr. Arness,
yes, Your Honor.
Could I ask you a couple of questions about the first branch of your adversary's argument, the question of the source of this rule and why it's a federal rule? You do not contend the rule itself is constitutionally required, do you, the immunity?
We do not contend that it's constitutionally required.
And you don't contend that its source is any statute?
It's not the source of any statute.
But it's a common law. There's a federal common law rule on which you rely.
It is a rule based upon declared public policy, Your Honor.
Now, if it's a federal common law rule independent of statute, would it have applied to a court-appointed counsel before the money was appropriated to pay him? You know, a lot of us used to do this sort of work without any money. Would immunity have been available there?
I think it would. Once this court declared in Johnson versus Zerps that be a function, a governmental function, I think it would.
So it really has nothing to do with the fact that the Criminal Justice Act pays these people.
Yeah. My friend has argued that that all Congress did was provide payment. Congress didn't do that. Congress implemented a system or designed a system to implement this court's constitutional ruling of providing counsel. Now, this court in its wisdom left to Congress the devising of the means to accomplish this end. Congress did that. Congress has provided for a mixed system of public defenders and private lawyers appointed under the Criminal Justice Act to perform this very vital public service.
But that, and we are here this irrelevant morning. To the rule, as I understand.
Beg pardon?
If I understand you correctly, that's all irrelevant to the rule. That's not the source of the rule that you advocate.
That is that.
It'd be the same right to immunity if you were appointed by a local bar association pursuant to some committee procedure or something like that, and everybody worked free.
The source of the rule is
in criminal cases.
Well,
because
whether
the
I do not. The federal court is involved because this attorney was appointed under the Federal Criminal Justice Act in performing a federal governmental function. Now, I think the public policy argument would be equally applicable to a state lawyer.
Well, no, but supposing instead of being appointed under the Federal Criminal Justice Act, the Philadelphia Bar Association, where it had a committee that of young lawyers who did this on a volunteer basis, and they appointed such a lawyer to defend a defendant in a criminal case, would such a lawyer be entitled to the immunity under the rule that you're advocating that we should recognize? And if not, why not?
I think so on the basis of public policy, but I believe it would
not. Well,
that's
all you've got going for you, isn't it? There are no statutes or anything else.
That's correct.
Yeah.
We have going for us the public policy considerations which this court has paid attention to in every case of this kind that's been before the court. We contend that they are identically applicable to this case, plus we have this court's decision in the Criminal Justice Act making this particular function a federal governmental function. And that's why it would be incongruous, Your Honors, to have 50 states deciding on their own, under state common law principles, whether a Criminal Justice Act attorney appointed under the federal act had immunity or not. There has to be a federal rule on that.
Let's get away from 50 states and one state.
Yes,
Pennsylvania.
Sir. Yes, sir.
There are two defendants, hypothetical. One is paid for and one is court appointed. And they both pay no attention to the statute of limitations. The paid one gets sued and the appointed one cannot be sued. Right?
That's correct, Your Honor. Yes.
Mr. Arnes, I take it from the briefs that neither you nor your opponent think that Barr against Mateo has any bearing on the case. Am I correct in that understanding?
We think Barr against Mateo has been superseded by this court's decision in Imbler versus Packman and in Butts versus Economo, Your Honor.
By superseded, you mean overruled?
No, Your Honor. Certain parts of Barr versus Mateo, we contend, are still good law. In problems that do not arise to the dignity of constitutional rights, for instance, in ordinary questions, we think Barr versus Mateo still stands for the proposition there should be an absolute immunity.
I would think there was no claim in this case that there had been any violation of constitutional right. It's just a state negligence action, and
That's correct.
Don't know why Barr wouldn't. If the federal law governs this, I wouldn't know why Barr wouldn't be perfectly. Well,
I think it would, Your Honor. I think the two. I think
your big problem is that federal law controls and that Pennsylvania law hasn't got anything to do with it.
Your Honor, yes. Your Honor, that certainly is the thrust of petitioner's argument here. However, we think there can be no question about the applicability of federal standards because it's the administration of a federal statute and a federal governmental function that's involved here.
What about a case where a defendant chooses to exercise the constitutional right that the Ferretta case accorded him and decides to represent himself and the court appoints standby counsel? Is that standby counsel immune from later suit by the defendant who elected to go pro se?
If he's performing a governmental function and he stays within the scope of that governmental function, Your Honor, we respectfully submit he has absolute immunity.
And do you think he is performing a governmental function?
If he's appointed under the Criminal Justice Act to perform that service that indigents are constitutionally entitled to, yes, Your Honor.
Well, but are they constitutionally entitled under Ferretta to have standby counsel?
Well, I think there are I think the reason standby counsel is appointed, Your Honor, is to provide, even when the defendant doesn't want to have it, some semblance of effective assistance of counsel. And that is a constitutional right.
Well, Let's suppose that a federal defendant is convicted, and he claims that his constitutional rights were violated by the inadequate performance of his counsel, and his conviction is affirmed. His claim is rejected because in that court the standard for performance is a mockery or a farce. Is that still a standard in the Third Circuit?
No, it's not.
What is it?
It's not, Your Honor. Matter of fact, that standard is waning everywhere.
Let's just assume that the standard in the federal courts is farce or mockery, and that the lawyer's performance was within that. Then the defendant who was convicted turns around and sues under state law. And he says, well, it may be that you satisfied your obligations under the federal constitution, but the state is entitled to require you to hold you to a higher standard, namely just negligence. And you were negligent. Now, you're saying that he has no right to go into state court to make that sort of a claim.
I'm not saying that, Your Honor. I'm saying that if he goes into a state court and it's shown that he was performing a federal governmental function, his rights are to be governed by the public policy attendant to that, which gives him immunity.
You're saying that he would have an immunity defense under state law. I mean, an immunity defense to any state law claim.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes.
And that the state
the liability he's being charged with arose during the course of his performance of a federal governmental
function. What
possible
reason? What are the reasons for according immunity, absolute or qualified? The reason is that you don't want to deter, by a fear of liability, any of the performance of the officer's duty. A prosecutor, you don't want him to be fearless.
That's one of the reasons.
Now,
the other two reasons.
Apply that to a defense counsel. Now, how could he possibly be deferred from doing anything by fear of liability?
Well, Your Honor, one of the ready things that comes to mind is if his involuntary client insists that he voluntarily becomes a Criminal Justice Act attorney, but once he becomes on that list, then he gets an appointment. He doesn't choose it, and the indigent defendant doesn't choose him. There's an involuntary relationship created by the very essence of the act.
Now, wait a minute. Did you say that if he went to the judge and says, I just can't handle this, he couldn't get out?
Your Honor, the standards do not permit him to get out just because he doesn't like the situation. That's correct. And the standards of getting out or substituting or withdrawing are very difficult.
But nevertheless, he has held himself out as being a competent lawyer, competent enough to represent defendants in criminal cases.
That's
by
correct.
Volunteering.
He has held himself out to be competent. That's correct. Any lawyer who is admitted to the bar and practices holds himself out to be competent in the things he undertakes. But the question is whether there's an involuntary relationship created so as to distinguish that situation from the situation that confronts a privately retained attorney.
All right, well, go ahead. Tell me why he's entitled to immunity. What would he be deterred from doing if he didn't have immunity?
There are three reasons. His judgment would necessarily be affected, Your Honor, because if he thought that a certain trial tactic was in the best interest of his clients and his client insisted on something else, then he is put in an untenable position of either acceding to the client's request or subjecting himself to a malpractice action. This would have a dampening effect on his representation.
Well, how does that differ from hired counsel?
Hired counsel, because of the voluntary relationship, and particularly the right of choice, is chosen because the defendant thinks their judgment is worth having and they're paying for it and they are more prone to follow it and be satisfied with it. One of the first and essential requirements of handling a criminal case is to have the lawyer in charge so that he can do the best job for his client. Now, that you can insist on in a private relationship. That is almost impossible in an involuntary relationship. And that is one of the major reasons why the public policy demands that court-appointed counsel be given immunity.
So he
So that he might be tempted to follow his client's requests and orders when, if he were hired counsel, he wouldn't.
Yes, Your Honor. Every court that's considered this problem that we know of has stated that to be the case.
And then what follows from that?
What follows from that is that in order to put him in a posture where he can effectively represent and do his duty, immunity should be granted. For that and for two other reasons.
But suppose he does follow his client's directions where otherwise he wouldn't. What happens then?
If he follows his client's direction, that's the path of easiest way out. His client probably is not well served, but he maybe dodges a malpractice action. And that is exactly what the Criminal Justice Act should not do.
Is it not, have there not been occasions where a defense counsel, paid now for the moment, paid defense counsel, privately retained, has informed the court out of the hearing of the jury that he has advised the defendant not to take the stand, and that he wants the court to know that he's given that advice, but the defendant insists on taking the stand. Now, taking that hypothetical, is the situation any different for a privately retained lawyer or a public defender, such as we have here?
That situation, in its essence, of course, is no different, Your Honor. But it's almost inevitably that it will occur in an involuntary relationship,
where
it should not occur in a private voluntary relationship.
Is the fearlessness factor any different in the two? If the lawyer is skilled enough to realize that that's in the particular situation, that that's a desirable thing to do for his own protection.
Yes, because the privately retained attorney can say, if you don't want my advice, then you here's your money and you can get another lawyer.
Well, but in the middle of a trial, that's...
Worked out long before the middle of the trial, Your Honor. Obviously, there can occur things during the middle of a trial where even a privately retained lawyer could have a disagreement with his client. There's no doubt about that. The question is whether or not the involuntary relationship increases the risk and hazard of litigation.
Mr. Arnes, I question the basic premise on which you're arguing. You're suggesting a situation in which a lawyer in his professional judgment thinks he should do A, and the client says, I'd rather have you do B. And the lawyer thinks it would be stupid to do B, so he does B anyway to protect himself from a suit. I submit he's more likely to be guilty of malpractice if he follows a stupid request of his client and doesn't follow his own professional judgment.
Your Honor, the public...
I don't think that'd be a defense to a malpractice suit to say that my client asked me to do this stupid thing.
I think you're absolutely right, Your Honor, but that is not the question. The public policy considerations here are not because there may be ultimate liability in a malpractice suit. We would presume that in most instances a malpractice action, because we argue in our brief that it would be really, it's not well calculated to serve the interest, would not be availing. The public interest is in freeing the lawyer from having to go through and prove and being sued and spending the money and being harassed and having to prove that his judgment was correct and that the conviction would have happened anyway.
One of the costs of taking on cases like this is exposure to the risks of complaints before the Ethics Committee, the Bar Association, malpractice suits, all these sort of things. There are these complaints that are going to be filed against lawyers who take on this litigation, no matter what the rules are.
Yes, and we contend respectfully that post-conviction relief procedures, court disciplinary procedures, bar association disciplinary procedures are much better calculated to handle the situation that can be conjured up. Malpractice, because of the burden of proof requirements, because of the defenses that are available, and because of the fact that 2255 relief is a concomitant of the thing, where you could well have a court rule that there be a requirement to exhaust judicial remedies, and then you'd have collateral estoppel problems. Malpractice is really not well designed to get at the problem that we're talking about here, which is the competency of counsel.
Mr. Arnes, but, you told us earlier there were three reasons, and you gave one, and then we hardly gave you an opportunity to talk about the other two.
The other
now
two,
given us to,
yes,
to
Your Honor,
the 2255 and the disciplinary.
No, those are important considerations, but the other two are these, Your Honor. This court has held that the reason for immunity of the public policy is to prevent harassment. I have talked about that. And secondly, the the recruiting problem. It is absolutely essential for the proper functioning of the criminal justice system to draw well-meaning and competent counsel into this. If you read the legislative history, such as it is with the Criminal Justice Act, it's apparent that Congress wanted the participation of the private bar. Now, that participation is something that's necessary unless we're going to have a system where all defense is provided by public defender systems, which would not be a good thing. And this, as I say, the recruiting element has been discussed in most of the cases that are considered the immunity. We think it's a real concern. Those are the other two.
You think the actual fear of liability, damage liability, would deter? Because there's nothing you can do about, as Brother Stevens says, these complaints before Bar Association. Surely in the federal court itself, if the defendant is so minded, he can claim that he was inadequately represented, then his conviction should be reversed.
Yes.
And I suppose that he could if, let's assume he appealed and his conviction was reversed on the grounds that his counsel had inadequately represented him and had violated his constitutional rights. I suppose the defendant could turn around and sue him in a federal court in a Bivens-type action for violating his right to counsel.
Yes, Your Honor, he could, but...
You wouldn't suggest it.
No.
You wouldn't suggest there would be absolute immunity there, would you?
We don't believe that the Bivens situation is applicable here. That was a Fourth Amendment problem. That would not be within the scope of the duty of a court-appointed attorney. Your Honor, the 2255 relief, which this very petitioner could have filed more than 2 years ago, has just been filed in the month of September. Why? The record is silent. But that relief is much more appropriate, and that will do away completely with the 10-year sentence that he is complaining about here. If indeed...
damages in his lawsuit, too. Huh?
Pardon?
It'll do away with his damages in his lawsuit.
Yes, it would render this case moot and probably either that or improvidently granted certiorari.
It would render this case moot. Would it stop the man from having done the wrong that he allegedly did?
Your Honor, that should be done by courts and by Bar Association disciplinary procedures.
Well, why have malpractice at all?
Well, Your Honor...
You want malpractice on one but not the other.
I can only argue immunity on the basis of governmental function, Your Honor.
Do you support malpractice for private attorneys?
Yes, I do.
You think that's fine?
I think malpractice is, as a form of civil relief, is fine when a governmental function is not involved and when public policy does not contraindicate it.
And a private attorney is performing a governmental function?
I do not.
Did you ever read the oath that you took?
I hope so, Your Honor. I hope it's ingrained in my mind.
Mr. Arnaz?
Yes, Your Honor.
Does a record show, or do you happen to know, what an individual or sole practitioner would have to pay as a premium for malpractice insurance now, assuming he were regularly defending criminal defendants pursuant to appointment?
I do not know, but I assume it would be high. But I think that the question is not whether lawyers should have better malpractice coverage. That it isn't the threat of ultimate financial liability. It's the threat of the harassment and the deflection from the duty.
Why do you give that point away so quickly? If you were a sole practitioner, didn't have a law firm to provide malpractice insurance, would you rush to volunteer to defend these cases?
No, and I don't give it away too quickly, Your Honor. All I say is that malpractice can cover that threat.
If you have the funds.
If you can afford it, yes.
Doctors, I understand, are paying $20,000, $25,000 a year premiums.
Yes. And it is certainly a meaningful factor, but far more meaningful is that there are alternate ways to get at this problem which cannot be protected against and which the court can control.
Mr. Arnaz, do you happen to know how many states there's a rule in cases like this that the criminal defendant, in order to recover in a malpractice action, has to prove that he was innocent? I think some states require that to show the actual harm.
Your Honor, I think the substantial weight of the authority requires that in a malpractice action. And one of the ills, of course, is the thought of trying a criminal action over again in a civil environment with a lay jury is something public policy, again, should not countenance.
Of course, there's a pretty large proportion of these cases where the plaintiff in the malpractice action could never carry that burden of proof. as a practical matter?
Well, I think it would be very, very difficult, Your Honor. I see my white light is on. I'd like to close, Your Honor, by stating that it's respondents' position here, in this case, that the public policy considerations which this court has applied in every federal court, we do not know of a single federal appellate decision that has ever refused to grant a governmental function immunity. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in